Leonard, we're approaching the date of the oral arguments now, and can you please explain the stage that we're at and what the key issues that will be argued? Will all nine issues be argued, or will there be a focus?
Well, the argument will be before a two-judge court, and possibly that court will be increased to a three-judge court. But we won't know that until a week before the argument. This is the court, the same court, that initially heard the case and decided in August of 2005 that the five did not receive a fair trial in Miami. That decision was reversed by the entire 12 justices of the 11th Circuit. And so that issue is no longer available to us. But the rest of the case, aside from the issue of fair trial and venue, has been returned to the original court, now composed of two judges, with the possible addition of a third, for consideration of all the remaining issues. There are a number of remaining issues, but I will highlight the three most important, which will most likely be addressed in this argument. First is the issue of whether or not the count that alleges a conspiracy to commit murder against Gerardo Hernandez, arising out of the shootdown of two aircraft in 1996, can be sustained on appeal. The defense is arguing that the evidence on that alleged conspiracy is insufficient as a matter of law. The argument is strong because the government at one point in the litigation acknowledged that their evidence was very weak and that they couldn't in fact prove that count. It is also impacted by the fact that the court, when we originally argued the case, also expressed its opinion that the evidence on that count was weak. So our initial focus is to remove count three, which is the count that alleges conspiracy to commit murder against one of the five, Gerardo Hernandez. I should also point out that this is the first time in history that an individual is being held liable for the action of a sovereign state in defending its airspace. The count should never have been indicted in the first place because Cuba had the right to defend its airspace in shooting down these aircraft. But even assuming that it is legally viable, it was never proven. The second argument that will take a considerable amount of the court's attention is the question of prosecutorial misconduct, particularly the misconduct of the prosecutor in his final argument to the jury. That argument is constrained by very precise rules of law that prohibit counsel from arguing outside the scope of the evidence. In other words, a prosecutor cannot make claims in the final argument that are without any evidence or proof in the case. In this particular instance, the prosecutor went far beyond the bounds of proper argument. For example, he claimed at one point that the five came to the United States not to monitor the activities of the terror network that had been assaulting the Cuban people, but he argued that their purpose in coming was to destroy the United States. That was mentioned not once, but three times in the course of his argument. The five were unarmed. They carried no explosives. They committed no acts of sabotage or arson. They threatened no one. And yet the prosecutor made that claim. We contend that that is outrageous prosecutorial misconduct. And because of that, both the count alleging conspiracy to commit murder and the count alleging conspiracy to commit espionage, which were closely argued counts, must be set aside and a new trial ordered on those counts. The third argument that will have prominence is the question of the sentencing of the three of the five who were accused of conspiracy to commit espionage. Each of the three who were so accused received a life sentence. A life sentence now means that you actually serve your entire life without getting out of prison prior to your death. This case was the first case in the history of the United States to be brought where there were no classified documents involved. That is, there was nothing of a national security published matter that was in this case. The notorious cases historically are cases involving individuals who turned over to a foreign country scores, sometimes hundreds and thousands, of state secrets. In those cases, these individuals, the most notorious of whom are people like Robert Hansen of the FBI, Aldrich Ames of the CIA, Robert Walker of the Navy, who gave hundreds if not thousands of documents away, each received life. But in this case, there were no such documents. Nonetheless, the three are serving the same life sentence as these most notorious spies. So we are arguing that this sentence, given the facts of this case, is oppressive, irrational, and outside the bounds of the statutory scheme. It was a sentence that obviously was reserved for Cuban patriots who took up the responsibility of exposing and trying to prevent the terror that emanates from the United States directed against Cuba. So those are the three main arguments. One, the conspiracy to commit espionage. Two, the conspiracy to commit murder. Those are the two main charges of the 26 charges. And third, the prosecutorial misconduct of the prosecutor. If we prevail on those issues, that will go a long way toward bringing the three back home to their families and compatriots in Cuba.
You mentioned about the prosecution not having had evidence to prove their charge of murder conspiracy. This is an extremely unusual and irregular charge, given that even the prosecution during the trial went to the 11th Circuit to appeal in as you've called it, writ of prohibition on the judge's instructions, because even they said they didn't have the evidence. Specifically, what was required for a conviction? And if you could explain the issue of the international waters.
What was required for a conviction under U.S. law was proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Gerardo had entered into an agreement whose objective was to bring about the deaths of the four individuals who died when the two planes were shot down. There is no evidence whatsoever that Gerardo had any knowledge that the shootdown was to occur. And therefore, the case failed in terms of its evidence. Beyond that, there never should have been even a charge of that nature, because that charge was unprecedented when a sovereign state was seeking to protect its own airspace, and in so doing, its military aircraft brought down intruding aircraft. That activity has never before resulted in an indictment against an individual who was in no way involved in that military action.
Didn't the prosecution also claim that he knew, that Gerardo knew that the planes would be shot down in international waters? Was the U.S. claim that it fell in international waters and was shot down part of their consideration?
Where the planes were shot down was not directly relevant.
Okay.
The prosecution's argument was that the illegal agreement of which he was allegedly a part was an agreement to shoot down the planes in international water. So, if the agreement was to shoot down the planes over Cuban airspace, there could not be such a charge. The requirement was the agreement was to shoot them down over international airspace.
And yet it's very key to understand that Gerardo was not part of any plan for the shootdown, not even though it was a justified and legal act by Cuba. Gerardo had no part in it anyway.
Yes, there's no evidence that he knew that there was going to be a shootdown. The only evidence was that he received a message that his compatriots were not to fly in the aircraft during that period of time. He was not told why, and he was not informed of what was to happen. He was simply told that his other people who were there with him were not to fly. That is far from saying that he had knowledge that there was going to be a shootdown.
On the question of sentencing, you explained just now that the sentence is life and that there is no possibility in federal prison for there to be parole or early release other than when someone dies. Has this always existed, this doctrine of life with no possibility of parole? And when did it change, if it's a change from the past?
Parole has been abolished in the federal system in the United States. And I believe that change occurred approximately in 1994. I might be off a year. So this case arose in 1998. It arose after the change. Therefore, the five were sentenced under the new rule which abolished parole.
Prisoners who were sentenced before that, when they receive life, are they eligible for parole?
The answer is yes.
Okay.
I believe they begin to get eligible when they have served approximately, it's either 32 or 34 years.
Why are there two judges instead of three?
The third judge retired from the bench approximately 2 years ago. And therefore, the case is remanded to the original three-judge panel, one of whom has retired, and therefore we now have a two-judge panel. It is possible that a third judge will be appointed to hear this case, but we will not know that until the week before the argument.
And what importance does this case have, do you believe, for the issue of U.S.-Cuba relations, as well as how does it also affect the people of the United States regarding justice and the right to legal justice in the court? How does it affect the average person in terms of the rulings that have been made and sentencing and charges and evidence?
Well, first, the ruling on venue, which has been decided and will not be before this court, but which we could appeal at a subsequent time to the United States Supreme Court, affects everyone who is brought before the bar of justice in America, because the venue rules prior to this decision have been rules that are designed to protect against being brought to trial before a community that is impassioned as a result of prejudice against the accused. That has been a fundamental and hallmark part of the criminal justice system. It was undermined by the decision of the 11th Circuit sitting en banc in August of 2006. If we lose before this panel, we will then have the right to raise that venue issue before the United States Supreme Court, and we will do it. So that affects everyone who is forced to trial in America. The question of sentencing also will affect everyone who is charged with conspiracies to commit espionage because of the draconian nature of this sentence. The conspiracy against Gerardo to commit murder will be a first-time precedent charging a person within the United States with a conspiracy to commit murder for an outside sovereign's right to protect its own airspace. So this case, in many ways, will have impacts on the state of the law in the United States.
Now, since the five were wrongly convicted in 2001, although their defense attorneys, and they tried to show, despite the obstacles posed by the judge, they tried to show the history of terrorism in Miami and the reason for, the sole reason for their mission in Miami and Southern Florida to stop the terrorism, which even continues today. And since their conviction, there have been discoveries, revelations of continued plots, including attempted assassination of the president of Cuba. What role could this discovery play in the struggle for their freedom? And can you please comment about the release of the most notorious terrorist without charges, completely free of charges, of Luis Posada Carriles in Miami? Doesn't this have any possible consideration in the courts or in U.S. policy?
Of the nine issues that will be argued before the two-judge panel, I've only mentioned the three main issues we will be arguing. There are six additional issues. One of them is the issue of justification. Under American law, a person who is accused of a crime could acknowledge committing that crime, but then argue the crime was justified out of necessity to avoid a greater harm. It's a form of self-defense. only it's extended to acts which will protect other parties. This was argued in the original trial, but the trial judge took that issue away from the jury, so it was never considered by the jury. We claim that was error, and we will be arguing that that claim should have been submitted to the jury, because the five came to the United States in order to prevent additional violence and additional injury and harm to others. The reason why I didn't mention it initially is that the courts in the United States have a tendency to discredit that defense, particularly in the political context in which it was raised in this case. However, when you look at the revelations involving Posada Carriles and Orlando Bosch and others who the government has conceded was involved in acts of terrorism, and that the five came here to curb their activities, this case presents a stronger record than any case that I'm aware of for the argument that their activities were justified and necessary in order to save lives. I used it successfully in the defense of President Carter's daughter, Amy, when she occupied a building at the University of Massachusetts in opposition to the recruitment by CIA agents who came to the campus to recruit students into the CIA. She acknowledged that her occupation of the building was a crime, but she argued that that was justified by the doctrine of necessity because the CIA was then engaged in an illegal war in Nicaragua. It was argued to the jury, and Amy Carter and her 16 other student defendants were all acquitted.
On the question of the discoveries of the terrorist plots in southern Florida since their conviction, is there any possibility for an appeal or filing of habeas motion in regards to strengthening the original argument of their mission of fighting terrorism? Is there a possibility of appeal on this basis?
Well, the trial lawyers did a very good job in bringing before the court and jury 35 exhibits demonstrating the long history of terror violence directed against Cuba from the southern Florida area. They also produced live witnesses who were involved in those actions for the jury to see and hear. In fact, our original panel of judges, when they wrote a 93-page opinion reversing the case because of the prejudice in Miami, cited in footnotes the evidence that was produced in court and referred to Carriles as a terrorist, which I think is the first judicial finding that those activities directed against Cuba were in fact terrorist activity. So that was all before the judge in the original trial, but the judge took that issue away from the jury. Now, can we, if we lose this appeal, file a new appeal under habeas corpus incorporating some of this new information which has come to light since the end of the trial? And the answer is probably yes, and it's something that we will definitely look into because we're keeping records of all the new information once this argument is concluded and we have a decision.
And you explained that you will be focusing on three issues. Is that because of the time you have in the oral arguments, or overall in this appeal?
The appeal comprises 119 volumes of transcripts from the original trial, plus 20,000 pages of exhibits. We have been given a total of 30 minutes to argue all 9 issues. If you spread that out, it gives us 3 minutes per issue. As happens with respect to all appeals, the lawyers have to make a judgment as to which issues they will be arguing. And so, after meetings with all counsel, we have focused on the 3 issues that we feel will bring about a reversal of the major charges and set the path for the release of the 5. But it still only gives us 5 or 6 minutes per issue that we're trying to argue. So the 30-minute limit does dictate the issues that we will be able to argue and how much time we can spend on each issue.
But in the written briefs, you address all issues?
They're all addressed comprehensively. And there is also a limitation on the number of words you can put in a written brief. But we have used all of the space that has been allocated to us in arguing all 9 issues.
Have you been in communication with the 5, and how are their spirits? How is their...
I'm in most frequent communication with Antonio Guerrero, and I just received a letter from him, which is dated July 19th. It's in front of me. And his spirits, as usual, are very high. He's fully aware of what's happening in court and the arguments we're about to make. And he remains strong and optimistic.
You have a long history of defending people who are political activists since the 1960s. Do you, and in this case, there's an international movement of support for the Cuban Five's freedom. Do you believe that, how do you see the importance of the political movement in regards to this case? And are you seeing any kind of change in the interest of the media?
This case is the first case in everyone's memory that is going to be argued a third time on appeal. To all of our collective memories, this has never happened before. Why is it happening in this case? We believe it's happening because of the international and domestic attention that this case has received. As lawyers, we know that we have the right to argument, and we have the right to written appeals. But we also know from experience, whether or not the arguments are heard or the appeals are taken seriously frequently depends upon how extensive the support is and the interest is in the case. And it is a tribute to what has been done.
Okay, Leonard, thank you so much.